Case number 075401, Ruby Taylor, appellant versus Elaine Elchoff, Secretary of Labor et al. Mr. Swick for the appellant, Mr. Adebanojo for the appellees.
Police Court, my name is Richard Swick. I represent the appellant, Ruby Taylor. From our view, there are two principal issues in this appeal. First, whether, as a matter of law, Ms. Taylor was unreasonable in how she responded to the workplace abuse that she encountered. And second, on a retaliation claim, whether the district court was free to ignore her testimony about how her managers interfere with her ability to be productive in retaliation for her EEO complaints. The discrimination case was decided under Farragher, and of course Farragher is an affirmative defense, and it's employer's burden to show that there's an unreasonable failure on the part of the employee to use the procedures that were set up. And here there's plenty of evidence for the jury to conclude that her actions were not unreasonable, particularly that, just the whole environment that they create from the beginning. You have this scavenger hunt. You know, why in the world the federal agency has its employees over in Rocky Park looking for an adult plastic toy and a female coworker, you know, being...
Oh, they can do less harm there than they could somewhere.
I was just thinking of the contractor that got $100,000 to organize that.
That's another grievance we all have as taxpayers. Mr. Swick, when you say when you start to talk about whether her conduct was reasonable, in your brief, at least one of the aspects on which you rely is her going to talk to Mr. Smith. I think it was right, who was a management official, but not in the EEO line.
That's right.
Okay. So, insofar as that's concerned, the procedures are otherwise, right? So, I mean, I don't see how that can be taken as relevant to whether she acted reasonably, or at least how it can help show that she acted reasonably. She went to talk to somebody. She didn't follow the procedure.
I think that there's like two different concepts here that are different. I mean, one's exhaustion of remedies. In order to have a timely EEO complaint, she needs to go to a counselor within 45 days. She has a timely complaint because she did go to a counselor within 45 days of the last act of harassment. The second, though, is whether she puts the employer on notice of what's going on. Now, Mr. Smith is not an EEO counselor, but the agency has a policy that managers that get wind of something like this are supposed to bring it up to the EEO office.
I thought the policy was that they were supposed to maintain an environment free of harassment, as distinct from a duty to report.
But isn't that the same thing?
Not necessarily.
It seems to me that if you're a manager and you're supposed to maintain an environment that's free of harassment, and you get word that there's harassment, even if it's not you personally.
The distinction might be that you're the manager of Division A, and your duty is to be sure that Division A is free of any harassment. If the plaintiff works in Division B, under the way I read the employer's policy, you don't have any responsibility. I mean,
I don't think it says that, but can it really say that? Does that make any sense at all?
Sure, it does, because the employer, the employee here has the option that way of stepping out of the line of supervision and talking to someone before making a decision that's going to have repercussions. She can get some feedback from a manager in another division, and she hasn't revealed anything. She has reserved her decision of whether to make a complaint or not by talking to her own supervisor or going to her EEO counselor.
I don't see how you can read all that into this policy.
Well, she was on good terms with Smith, right? She felt she could go talk with him.
Right, and he wasn't particularly encouraging about the whole thing. I mean, in a way, you sympathize.
Although ultimately, she goes and files a complaint.
Yeah, when she feels physically threatened. So when she does that, then she's got a time to complain. How is she unreasonable in not using her procedures then?
Right, so now that complaint relates back for 45 days unless the management or the other employee somehow prevented her or intimidated her from filing earlier.
Well, sexual harassment, I mean, it does go back 45 days, which would cover some of the things, but most notably the incident in the copy room when she felt physically threatened. But sexual harassment is a cumulative and continuing type thing, and as long as there's a timely act, I think that everything that's involved in the chain of events ought to come in, and that's what has to.
Is there any authority for that? That sort of eviscerates, or at least very much dilutes the time.
That's what the court says in Morgan, I think that in Green, you talk about that there's a dilemma for the employee about at what point does it accumulate enough that it's now reasonably actual. But you know what we're ignoring here? The fact that this manager, the whole thing was set up to intimidate her, and this manager was very intimidating about it. She was concerned that he was going to become her new boss, our new second level boss. He told her over and over again that your boss is my friend. He's not going to do anything.
This is Bacon?
Bacon, right.
Okay.
Her boss is Hinkle, and then they both work for Joy. You know, even when they have this incident, you know, this scavenger hunt thing, she comes back to the office, and, you know, the second level boss, Joy, talks to her about it, and, you know, he thinks the thing is a big hoot. I mean, how is that going to make her feel that going to her employer about this is going to remedy it? And in fact, she turned out right when she did go. Her environment changes, her evaluations go down.
Well, when she does report, I mean, assuming all of her allegations are true, when she does report, an investigation is promptly conducted and a conclusion reached. Now, she may not agree with the conclusion, but it's not that the employer didn't do anything and indeed had somebody from the Office of General Counsel conduct the investigation.
I believe that them having somebody conduct an investigation was the right thing for them to do, and I think it did have a good effect on the work environment, at least as far as Bacon, you know, quit harassing her because of that. But, you know, that's what we say looking at it after the fact. We're looking at whether what she did was reasonable. That's what they have to show to establish the defense, that what she did was unreasonable.
But the argument that the employer has is that had she reported, we would have investigated earlier.
Just as here, it
might well have been that none of these later incidents would have occurred.
That doesn't go to whether she's reasonable or unreasonable, though. What she's got is she's got a boss saying, you know, when she complains these harassers, stop talking to me that way, or turn around and look at me, or, you know, go ahead, tell him. He won't do anything. I'm a family man. You know, I'll blame you. But, you know, that's what she's hearing over and over. And it's made worse by the fact that, you know, his boss calls her sweetie and thinks that, you know, things like scavenger hunt and asking her about her pubic hairs is a big joke. You know, why is she supposed to have any confidence in the thing that way? I mean, what she's trying to do is a very reasonable thing. She's trying to make, do her job, get along with this guy, and have him not harass her. And she takes several months at that course, and when she finally feels like that she, you know, that he's physically threatening her, then she does activate the process. She didn't fail to activate the process. She activated it in a timely way. After trying to work with her herself, and you know, to fault her for how she responded to this is, you know, it makes the law meaningless. And to let them get away. You read this thing, page 156. You read her, you read what this guy's doing to her. He's a sexual predator. I mean, can I be your friend? Come on. Why can't I be your friend? This guy's your friend. I mean, that's nobody should have to put up with that. And she's trying to cope with it the best way she can, and she doesn't cope with it in an unreasonable way, and she shouldn't have her claim barred for trying to do it reasonably.
Thank you, Mr. Smith.
Good morning. May it please the court, the district court correctly entered summary judgment for the PBGC because it found that PBGC had a policy in place and that policy was well disseminated. The appellant admits that she knew about the policy, and the policy had been disseminated via email to all employees. It was on the PBGC's intranet that all employees had access to, and it found that the appellant unreasonably delayed in taking advantage of the opportunities that policy affords by not following the policy and reporting to an EEO official. To address the appellant's point directly.
Well, she eventually reports or complains. So Mr. Swick says once she does that, that brings in to cognizance anything that happened prior to that. Why not?
When she reports.
She files a complaint.
When she files her complaint in April. Well, what the district court correctly said about that is that that according to the Farragut line of cases, the appellant has an obligation to report to mitigate her damages. And what the district court correctly said about that is that had she reported, say, after the team building Rock Creek exercise, which apparently they're putting a lot of emphasis on, that event took place sometime in July of 2001, I believe. And she didn't report until April. That's about 9 months or thereabout that elapsed. Had she reported after that incident, what happened in April when the PBGC initiated an investigation, and by her own admission, the alleged harassment stops, or at least she doesn't allege any harassment after that, would have happened sooner. So what subsequently happened could have been avoided, but she failed to follow the policy that required her, that was very specific as to who she should report to. And that policy can be found at in the joint appendix at 363.
So in other words, Morgan was not dealing with this affirmative defense. Supreme Court's decision in Morgan.
Because she unreasonably delayed, yes, I would agree with that.
Well, I just thought the court wasn't dealing with it at all.
I'm sorry, wasn't dealing with?
Well, counsel relies on Morgan.
Yes.
Once she makes a timely complaint, you just look back in time as well. And what I'm asking you is, does Morgan discuss this affirmative defense?
My best recollection of Morgan is that it doesn't, that Farragut is the controlling authority here, and it says that the crucial aspect to this is mitigation of damages, and that's also mentioned in this circuit's jurisprudence.
Well, let me ask you a question then about the defense itself. In order to rule for the employer here, the district court had defined that no reasonable jury could conclude that plaintiff reasonably delayed. Is that correct?
Well, there's some discussion about that in some of the cases, but the facts in those cases are clearly distinguishable from the facts here. In those cases, these are cases like the Green case where the victim...
I understand factual differences. I just want to understand what the rule of law is here that the district court had to apply.
Well, the district court properly decided on these facts that...
Now, what I'm getting at, did the district court... I'm not saying that a reasonable fact finder could not have found as the district court found. What I'm getting at is, in order to cut the case off at the point the district court did not the district court have to be able to say that taking the allegations of the plaintiff as true, no reasonable jury could find that her delay in following the employer's policy was reasonable?
I think that that's what the district court did.
All right. Well, if the district court had to do that, didn't she present issues that raised material issues about the reasonableness of her action?
No, because the district court took everything she said as true. So there were no disputed issues.
But she weighed the evidence is what I'm trying to get at. Or did she? That's what I'm...
No, I don't believe she did. I think the district court...
Well, the plaintiff obviously has a very different view of the environment she was working in. All right? And as counsel represented this morning, and as is clear in the record, she may not have felt physically threatened, but she felt threatened enough. And the district court's response is essentially doesn't matter. There was a policy out there, and she had to take advantage of it. And I'm not saying that's not the law, but I'm just asking
I think that that I think
case.
That that's I, yes, I think that that's that was the correct approach. That at and the district court said it clearly, and you'll forgive me if I repeat myself, that had she reported earlier, and there's evidence there is some evidence in the record that she felt harassed from much earlier when he was saying when Mr. Bacon was allegedly saying to her, I want to be your friend, because in the record at JA 60, she's saying, when he's saying that, she's thinking to herself, is this harassment that, you know, is this how they, what they said harassment is like in training? So she was clearly thinking about that way back in at least the fall of 2001, or maybe even earlier when they were jogging together. So it behooved her at that point.
The court ought to adopt what I thought Chief Judge Boudin suggested, that there is a very heavy burden placed on the plaintiff, and the Supreme Court understood this. Where the employer has a policy and it is clearly announced to the employees that if you're going to hold an employer vicariously liable, then there is an almost absolute standard that the plaintiff must use that remedy.
I would agree with that, Your
Honor. At the earliest possible moment, or she's out, or he's out.
I would agree that that is the policy behind the affirmative defense, that if the employer goes through the hoops to develop a policy that protects the employee,
I mean the employer has some obligation.
Yes, I agree. But in any case, does that? There's a reciprocal obligation on the part of the employee, especially one who knows what the policy is, to take advantage of the policy, especially when the policy worked almost flawlessly in this case. And had she done that earlier, we probably wouldn't even be here.
What do you say to her harassment allegations?
Her harassment? Well, again, the district court correctly decided in that case that she didn't.
Her retaliation.
Oh, her retaliation. Sorry. Well, again, the district court said, and correctly so, that that the allegation that Mr. Hagan said to her, "You should try and curb your negative behaviors," was not a materially adverse action.
What about the performance evaluations?
Well, the
first one, but the second one. In other words, the employer says, "Well, she got the outstanding because she did the extra work."
Correct.
And she got the, what was it, well qualified?
Excellent.
That was the second. That was the first year. Excellent. The next time.
Yeah.
And the following year, she got
fully satisfactory.
Correct. In 2003.
And the evidence is that the evaluations turned on productivity. And her allegation is that her employers retaliated against her by interfering with her ability to be productive after she filed this complaint.
It was a conclusory allegation. The district court said that she didn't present any evidence to support that claim.
She had her testimony.
Uncorroborated, that her work was that her work that someone was manipulating her workflow, but also the district court said that historically she had one outstanding during the period of time that the district court looked at. She had one outstanding which corresponded to the extra work she did, and before that she never had an outstanding.
Her argument was going to be that even taking her allegations as true, which the district court was obligated to do in granting summary judgment, it doesn't meet the burden she had to show retaliation in that there was an adverse impact.
I'm sorry, I didn't follow that, Your Honor.
Well, she has to show, doesn't she, in retaliation, that it had an adverse employment impact?
Yes, she does.
The district court said that these allegations taken as true didn't amount to a materially adverse effect, right?
Yes, I believe so.
Right, but
it wasn't that they were conclusory, but rather that she just hadn't met her burden of what she had to show to prove retaliation, and no jury could so find.
That's what the district court said, Your Honor.
There's also an undisputed fact in here that she processed fewer cases than all but one other of the auditors.
The record shows, Your Honor, that she was 7 out of 10 in caseload, 9 out of 10 in closing cases, and that there were two other employees who were also white males who were
Bi-weekly work frequent submission. Yeah.
Yes.
But were they subjected to harassment, sexual harassment?
I don't.
Her story is that she was a superb employee, and she even got an outstanding when she did extra work, and otherwise she got an excellent, and then everybody started retaliating against her. So I guess the question is a reduction in a performance evaluation an adverse employment
action? On these facts, no. And the cases that the appellant cites are cases.
I'm an employee, and I'm rated excellent all this time. And then all of a sudden I get this. Of course, she wasn't rated excellent all the time. I realize that. But just my hypothetical. I'm rated as an excellent employee. Then I file a complaint of sexual harassment. And then the next year, I'm fully satisfactory. No adverse employment.
Actually, that in Austin, the Austin case, the court says that exactly, that was a genuine case of a precipitous drop in an evaluation, but that's not the case here, Your Honor.
No, that's not the question.
But what did they say in Austin, and what is Austin?
What did Austin say? Is that not an adverse employment?
I believe Austin said that would be adverse.
It would be adverse.
I believe so.
Well, it's not in your brief. Is it in any of the briefs?
Well, they cite Austin, and I believe we responded to it.
Well, I don't know. Is it called Austin or something else?
Oh, it might be something. I'm sorry. Let me make sure.
See it in, under that name in the blue brief either. Could it be Anderson?
Might be Anderson. Yes, I'm mixing up my A's.
Mr. Swick says, a precipitous drop in performance appraisals may be evidence that an employer was motivated by discriminatory animus. Anderson.
They do that a lot, Your Honor.
And that's Judge Rogers' hypothetical, precipitous drop.
But doesn't the district court find that on 138, while the record does not indicate the precise month in 2003 when her performance was evaluated as fully effective, it must have occurred at least 8 months after her complaint of discrimination. This lack of temporal proximity does not support it. In other words, there's no causal connection. Isn't that another defect that the district court found, and isn't that correct on the record?
With regard to the
fully effective downgrading?
I'm not sure that the district court said that. That may well be, but I'm
read with the district
yes, then.
That
would be correct, Your Honor. If that
here's the sequence. She files her complaint April 9th of 2002, right?
Yes.
She's evaluated October 29th and gets an excellent.
Correct.
So that's after the complaint, she gets an excellent. That's what she got the year before the outstanding. When things were in a normal state, she'd gotten an excellent. She
yes.
gets another excellent. Then in October of 2003, she gets a fully effective. All right, that's pretty remote in time.
That would be not causally related. Yeah. I believe that's the court
mentioned. Well, what the district court said,
yes.
the benefit of the doubt, and said we know it's at least January of 2003.
It turns out it was October, but yeah. even if we're January, it's
right.
now a year and a half.
Correct.
Okay. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Swick, give you a minute. Did you have Mr. Swick have any time? Okay, we'll take 2 minutes then.
Your Honor, I want to, on Farragher, the Farragher itself does not create this sort of, if there's a policy, you have to use it or you lose. I mean, Farragher is based upon the reasonableness of what the employee does. I mean, even in Farragher, the employer has a policy, but because it's not adequately disseminated, they don't hold the Farragher to it, and so you know it turns completely on the reasonableness of what the employee does, whether or not the offense is going to apply. And here, you know, with managers actively doing what they can do to discourage her from making a complaint.
Wait a minute, who are you referring to?
Bacon.
But with the threatening her,
right?
Yeah. Okay.
I mean, and I think the timing on this too. The Rock Creek Park thing happens in the summer of 2001. He's not harassing her then, really. But it's important because it shows the environment they've created, and it goes to her expectation about what they're going to do about it. The harassment starts in the fall, and then her complaint gets filed in April. So the harassment's going on for about 6 months. Now, on Judge Henderson's point and you know having to do with the amount of time from when the complaint files to when her evaluations go down, and don't forget also that they dock her pay. They dock her pay for about 7 days' pay when they charge her with AWOL on this trumped up AWOL after she's put a leave slip in. They eventually give her that pay back, but they hold her pay for a year. I mean, those are all things that I think would deter someone. But on the nexus argument, this is not a case where she files this EO complaint on April 15th, August 28th, 2002, and then the case ends. The case just starts. I mean, she's got an active EEO case going on from that day on. I mean, there's affidavits being taken, there's people being questioned, and you know, it's, you can't say, oh, well, that, you know, that's old news. I mean, she's got a complaint. Okay, that's over with. You know, we all forgot about that, because they can't forget about it, because the case is going on actively. And that's what the court held in Singletary, that if where the person's actively pursuing their complaint, then the you have to look at the whole process. And there's plenty of evidence that was actively going on. In fact, it's still actively going on right this minute.
Refresh my recollection. She reported it to the general counsel's office before that, didn't she?
The report comes in April, but it's just the way their processing works, it, you know, with counseling.
And before she went to EEO, didn't she, or file the EEO complaint, didn't she go within PBGC to the general counsel's office and there was an internal investigation?
Right.
Am I confused? All right. And when
right.
was that?
That's in April, 2002.
2002.
Yes.
All right.
And then
they find no harassment, right?
They don't substantiate the charges.
Right, okay. And then in August of that year?
August 2002.
Is when she files the
EEO. Formal complaint.
And then October, a few months later, is when she gets her excellent rating.
Right. And then the next year, it's down. And then, but, you know, on the product.
Well, I mean, you know, we don't assume that the managers are infinitely patient and vindictive. You know, at a certain point in time, the thing
revenge
is
a dish best served cold. You've never heard that. I don't know why. I mean, they did it the first chance they got.
No, October was the first chance they got.
And it came down, and then they got another.
Well, it was excellent. If anyone wants to complain about excellent, I thought it was common ground that the outstanding was in recognition of taking on special additional work the previous year. It's the only outstanding she ever got.
They can give her other work. I mean,
but your point, I thought, was that that once she filed the EEO complaint, then all the investigation, the affidavits. And so the October excellent was just cover while the investigation was going on. That's when you said it wasn't just filed and then that was the end of it. There were affidavits, there was questioning going on, and so they're being looked at, her managers, and so they give her an excellent.
I think that, you know, that's one inference that can be drawn from it. You know, I think, you know, that's why that these things shouldn't go in summary judgment with these kind of facts. It has to. You know, the managers have to explain it, but her explanation should come in too. And as Judge Rogers pointed out, her productivity is dependent on what her managers let her do. If her work's going to sit in somebody's inbox or keep getting sent back to her over and over when that didn't happen before, that affects her productivity. And that's for, you know, that's the kind of stuff that the jury ought to sort out. But even apart from the evaluations, you know, when they dock her pay. Surely that will deter someone from making EO complaints.
How long a period? This is when they erroneously said she was AWOL?
Well, erroneous, I think, might be looking at the light most favorable to them. I would say falsely.
Well, falsely. Then how much time?
It was 7 days' pay.
Pardon me?
7 days' pay.
7 days. Okay. Any other questions? Thank you, Mr. Smith.
Thank you.
Case is submitted.